Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpoch, and today we're going to talk about another very highly tested topic, and that is liver physiology and the liver in general. Please note that we've already done other episodes on liver transplants specifically, so this will not be about how to do a transplant or the physiology intraoperatively during a liver transplant. This is going to be about patients with liver disease, how they behave, what we need to think about, and the physiology you might be tested on and you'll want to know. All right, so let's talk about some of the basics. Blood flow. So you'll want to remember, because these are the kind of little facts we learned in med school, but that get tested, they come up on tests, right? The blood flow to the liver. So 25% of the entire cardiac output goes to the liver. The portal vein supplies 75% of the blood to the liver, and the hepatic artery supplies the other 25%. So there's that dual supply of blood. But remember that they both supply about half of the oxygen. So this can be tricky. The portal vein supplies 75% of the blood, the hepatic artery 25% of the blood, but because the hepatic artery blood is richer in oxygen, they each supply 50% of the oxygen that the liver needs. There's relatively high flow through that system, especially the portal vein, much higher than a normal vein, and that's because there's low resistance. So average portal pressure is about 8 to 10, which compares to hepatic venous pressure of only 4 to 5. So there's that gradient pushing it forward. Now, of course, what happens when hepatocytes get injured is they get replaced over time by fibrous tissue, which impedes flow, and that means portal pressures have to increase in order to get that blood through the liver, and that, of course, leads to portal hypertension, which we'll talk about more later. There is a system called the hepatic arterial buffer response, and what that means is that when there's reduced portal flow, the hepatic artery actually has the ability to increase its flow by up to 100% to maintain oxygen delivery. So there is that nice system built in. You'll remember from medical school that microcirculation in the liver is divided into three zones. So there's zone one, which is the oxygen-rich zone around the periphery of the little lobule where you have the blood coming in around the periphery of that lobule. So that's the oxygen-rich zone. As you get closer toward the middle, kind of in the middle zone, you're zone two. And then, of course, zone three is the very middle where the vein is, the middle of that lobule. And because you're now getting ready to dump it into that hepatic vein, you're much lower on oxygen. And, of course, that zone three then is the highest risk for getting damaged in a hypoxic environment. The liver can also act as a storage vessel for blood. Up to a liter of blood can be stored in the liver, can be released in times of need. And so it acts as kind of that buffer for the body's store of blood. It can also store vitamins. So you get things like a year supply of B12. Also, iron is stored in the form of ferritin in the liver. The liver plays an essential role in energy production and storage. So it stores glucose as glycogen. It converts other carbohydrates to glucose, especially fructose and galactose, and it synthesizes glucose from amino acids and triglycerides, and that's called gluconeogenesis. Cirrhotics, people with end-stage liver disease, can have very low serum glucose, especially as they get really further toward the end of their liver function completely. And that's because the body really relies on the liver to supply glucose into the bloodstream when you're not eating. And so that's kind of one of the really important signs there in cirrhotics, is that they can have low glucose. They can have relatively low glucose even before end stage, but certainly at end stage, that's a very important marker. The liver also synthesizes fat, cholesterol, phospholipids, and lipoproteins. It metabolizes fat and provides other sources of energy both for itself, for the liver, and for the rest of the body. Cholesterol, of course, is an important part. It's converted to bile salts and then secreted in the bile, and then that is then recirculated. We'll talk about that. And the rest is used to make cell membranes and other structures. So cholesterol has gotten a bad rap, but it's actually a very important molecule in the body, and it's made, most of it is made in the liver. The liver, of course, makes all plasma proteins except the gamma globulins, or your immunoglobulins. Those are made in plasma cells. Albumin is the main protein made in the liver, and it, of course, makes all non-essential amino acids, which it makes from keto acids. Now, the essential amino acids can't be made in the body, and that's why those are essential. They have to be eaten in the diet. The liver also does deamination of amino acids to make energy or produce carbs or fats, and this process produces ammonia, which is then removed by forming urea. We'll talk more about that as well. The liver makes all clotting factors except factor 3, which is tissue thromboplastin, factor 4, which is calcium, factor 8, and von Willebrand's factor, which kind of goes along and is often complexed with factor 8. So all the other ones except for 3, 4, and 8, and von Willebrand factor, are made in the liver. Now, the important thing about this is in liver failure, you get a lot of your factors are low, but factor 8 is the one that comes up a lot, is high, because it's not made in the liver, and so there's probably an extra production of it to try to compensate for the lack of other factors being made in the liver. So you'll see that come up on tests a lot, where they'll give you a list of maybe things that you might see in someone with end-stage liver disease, and they may throw in there a high factor 8, and you might think, oh, that's wrong, they have low factors. But remember, factor 8 actually is high in those liver patients. The liver also makes bile, of course, which is stored in the gallbladder and then released when fat enters the duodenum. That bile solubilizes the fat. It almost acts like a detergent to break it up into little molecules, which can then be absorbed. And then the bile salts, which are part of the bile, are returned to the liver via the portal vein. That's called the enterohepatic circulation. And it's really important because without that recycling and without that bile and those bile salts breaking up that fat, you also can't absorb vitamin K. So in patients with cholestasis and the inability to effectively secrete bile into their intestines, you can see low vitamin K. So vitamin K insufficiency, vitamin K deficiency is something you can see in cholestasis, especially long-standing cholestasis. And finally, one of the neat things about the liver, of course, is it can regenerate itself after injury or surgery. From as little as one-third of the original liver mass, you can regenerate the liver almost entirely. Let's talk about how we assess the function of the liver. So we refer to AST and ALT as liver function tests, but of course they don't actually assess function. They assess cellular injury. ALT is primarily in the liver, whereas AST is also in other tissues such as the heart, skeletal muscle, kidney, and brain. So ALT is more specific for the liver. Fatty liver and chronic infection can give you a mild 2 to 3 time increase in your AST and ALT, while acute hepatitis has a significantly larger increase. And then with hepatic necrosis, you get a super high increase into the many, many thousands. A decline in the level can be due to recovery, but be careful. It can also be due to the lack of any hepatocytes left to die. So you want to be careful when you're interpreting from a hepatic necrosis standpoint the recovery. The AST to ALT ratio is usually greater than 2 in alcoholic liver disease, where in viral hepatitis and other forms, it's usually less than 1. So that's one thing you can use to help differentiate there. Alkaline phosphatase, of course, often delineated AP, is an indicator of bile obstruction. But it's also in other tissues, especially bone. It can also be in the placenta in pregnant women. But the main things outside of pregnancy we think of it in are the liver or in the bile as an indicator of bile obstruction in the biliary system and then in bone. There's something called 5' NT, and those elevations are pretty specific for hepatobiliary obstruction. We used to look at GGT, but that's been replaced more by 5' NT for that specific purpose. When you get an increased level of bilirubin, that's primarily going to be from breakdown of hemoglobin. That's where the bilirubin comes from in our blood, is usually from a breakdown of hemoglobin when red blood cells die, which of course they do regularly. If you have an elevated unconjugated level of bilirubin. That's either going to be from excess production, in other words, hemolysis, or a decrease in uptake and conjugation by the liver, by the hepatocytes. Increased conjugated bilirubin is going to be from either impaired intrahepatic excretion or extrahepatic obstruction. In other words, the liver has now processed the bilirubin and turned it into conjugated bilirubin, but it can't get it out into the bile, or it's into the bile, but then it can't get out of the gallbladder because there's obstruction of the gallbladder or the other bile ducts. So how do we measure liver function if liver function tests don't actually measure function? So you can look at things the liver makes. Albumin is a one that will give you a more longer-term view, but of course, albumin has a relatively long half-life, and so it won't help you very much to get an acute picture. But your PT and INR are nice and give you a more short-term view because factor 7, which is what they're primarily testing, has a relatively short half-life and is made in the liver. So an elevated PT, though it can be from low vitamin K or, of course, from exogenous things like warfarin, but it can be a good indicator of liver function. And then platelets are another thing, and we'll talk more about why platelets are dependent on the liver. But those are things to look at for liver function. A few words about hepatobiliary imaging. So ultrasound is a main screening tool for hepatic parenchymal disease and extrahepatic biliary disease. It's obviously low risk in terms of invasiveness. It's very good at detecting gallstones, ascites, and portal or hepatic thromboses. There are radioisotope scans that are still used for cholecystitis, and so you may hear about those, and those are looking to see if you can light up the biliary tree and the common bile duct and the gallbladder. If you see the biliary tree lit up but not the gallbladder, that suggests that there is a blockage in the cystic duct and that you have an inflammation of the gallbladder. CT, of course, gives you more information and is better for looking at mass lesions. MRI, even better for looking at malignant focal lesions and diffuse liver disease. You can do percutaneous transhepatic cholangiography, or THC, injecting contrast into bile ducts, and that can help identify the site of biliary obstruction, if that's what you have. And then you can also do interventions, such as balloon dilation of strictures and placement of stents and drains. And then ERCP, of course, can access the pancreatic and common bile ducts, and through that access, you can do a sphincterotomy, stone extraction, biopsies, balloon dilation, and stent placements. And then liver biopsy, of course, can be important to evaluate the actual cause of liver damage, whether it's necrosis, inflammation, steatosis, fibrosis, etc. All right, hepatic and hepatobiliary diseases. So the most common acute causes of hepatobiliary disease are drug toxicity and infection. Acetaminophen toxicity is the leading cause of acute liver toxicity, and then chronic causes of hepatobiliary disease are, of course, viral, alcohol, and then the most increasing over the most recent time is NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD, which is because of the current obesity epidemic becoming a more and more common cause. And, of course, chronic disease can lead to things like portal hypertension, cirrhosis, and malignancy in the form of hepatocellular carcinoma. All right, let's talk in a little more detail about acute liver failure. So encephalopathy with coagulopathy, usually defined as an INR greater than or equal to 1.5, in a patient with no previous liver disease and now with an illness of less than 26 weeks is what defines acute liver failure. So it's that combination of encephalopathy and coagulopathy. About 45% of people who have acute liver failure will spontaneously recover, 25% will need a transplant, and 30% will die without getting a transplant. The most immediate cause of death in acute liver failure is acute cerebral edema and elevated intracranial pressure. And this is important. This will come up on tests that these people who have acute liver failure will die. There's a lot of things that you think about with liver failure, bleeding, et cetera, but the most common cause of death is actually acute cerebral edema. This is an acute liver failure, not chronic, an acute liver failure. And that risk tracks with the level of encephalopathy. So the more encephalopathic someone is, the more likely they have elevated ICP and acute cerebral edema, which can lead to death. The mechanism is not fully understood, but ammonia seems to play a role because brain cells, the only way they can detoxify ammonia is by making glutamine, which then draws in water, especially to astrocytes, and causes astrocyte swelling. So you need to know how to treat or deal with suspected or confirmed cerebral edema. You, of course, can put the head of the bed up to increase drainage and keep the head in a neutral position so you're not blocking venous return. You can consider muscle relaxants to avoid things like coughing that can increase intracranial pressure. Mannitol can be helpful if they have good renal function. And hypertonic saline to get the blood sodium level in the 145 to 155 range. You'll hear about hyperventilation as a potential tool, but remember, this is really only to be used for acute rises in ICP as a bridge to another treatment because the response is relatively short-lived and there hasn't been shown to be a survival benefit. So you shouldn't just hyperventilate someone because they have elevated ICP, only if it's an acute rise that you need to deal with just acutely while you do other things. Barbiturates or propofol can reduce cerebral metabolism, but of course can also cause systemic hypotension and reduce blood flow. So you want to be careful with those. Lactulose and rifaximin can help eliminate ammonia, but there's really no evidence for their use in acute liver failure, which is as opposed to chronic liver failure. You can consider an ICP monitor. And if you have an ICP monitor in place, you want to target a cerebral perfusion pressure, which is the mean arterial pressure minus intracranial pressure of 50 to 80. Sometimes people will talk about mild hypothermia as a way to help. The criteria for a transplant in patients with acute liver failure most often is the King's College criteria, and it looks at the cause, as in acetaminophen versus other, and then markers of severity. Elevated INR and low platelets don't correlate well in these patients with bleeding risk. So that's really important to keep in mind. You know, you see these liver patients with high INRs and think that they're at high risk for bleeding, but it doesn't necessarily correlate. So really, if they're not actively bleeding, you want to have pretty liberal, pretty conservative transfusion thresholds. In other words, platelets less than 10,000, INR greater than 7, fibrinogen less than 100. Those are times to think about transfusing in the absence of bleeding. The hepatitis viruses, these come up on tests as well. So remember, there are vaccines for hepatitis A and B. There is not a vaccine for hepatitis C or D or E for that matter. Patients who have hepatitis B and remain positive for that hepatitis B surface antigen for more than 6 months after recovery from acute illness are likely to go on to develop chronic infection, but it's pretty low risk for chronic infection. Only 2 to 5% of people with a hep B acute infection will go on to develop chronic infection, and that's as opposed to hep C, which has by far the highest rate of progression to chronic disease. 50 up to 85% of people with hepatitis C will go on to develop chronic disease. Hepatitis D has to be a co-infection or superinfection along with hepatitis B, so it doesn't work on its own. It has to be in conjunction with hepatitis B. Hepatitis E is less common, at least in the United States, and associated a little bit more with pregnancy at times. And hepatitis A is not associated with chronic infection. It just causes acute infection, often associated with contaminated food. Hepatitis B is thought to be transferred in blood products and contamination of blood, like a splash into the eye in a hospital. Hepatitis C is often transferred from shared needles used in drug use. I said before that hepatitis A is often thought in contaminated food or feces and transferred from the fecal-oral route. So key things to remember here in terms of what may come up on a test. Hepatitis A, no chronic disease, just acute, and there is a vaccine. Hepatitis B, low risk for advanced to chronic disease, and there is a vaccine, and there is risk of it being transferred via blood. And then hepatitis C, no vaccine, high risk for chronic disease. And in fact, I may not have mentioned, hepatitis C is the leading cause of liver transplant in the United States. And it is often found to be transferred via contaminated needles used in illegal drug use. Hepatitis D has to be a co-infection or a superinfection with hepatitis B. And hepatitis E is going to be less likely to be tested. So those are the things to keep in mind that you might see pop up on tests. The other thing to know, and it's relatively recent, and you may not see a lot of it on tests, but is that, of course, there's been a huge success with antivirals for hepatitis C with cure rates in the 85 to 100% range, depending on the strain and the patient. So even though it is a very serious disease with no vaccine, there is now really, really great treatments. And though it still remains the number one cause of liver transplant in the United States, we may see that be less true over time. you'll hear and maybe even see come up on test halothane hepatitis, because there was a lot of scare and it was one of the reasons halothane really isn't used anymore, but it's thought to be actually very uncommon. About 20% of people after halothane use may have a mild self-limited rise in LFTs, but without any sequelae. Their severe form, there's thought to be a separate severe form that is likely immune mediated and very, very rare. Again, we don't use halothane in the United States anymore, but it's possible you could still see that popping up on a test. Pregnancy-related liver diseases. So 3 to 5% of pregnancies can be complicated by liver disease. Hyperemesis gravidarum, which is not, we don't usually think of as a liver disease, so that's just excessive vomiting in the first trimester or a little beyond, can actually have up to a 20-fold elevation in LFTs, but it usually resolves by the second trimester and does not need any treatment. Intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy usually happens later in the second or third trimester. You get elevated serum bile acids and really bad pruritus. Those are the hallmarks. You can also see an LFT rise up to 20-fold and serum bile acid levels up to 100-fold increase. Treatment is just supportive, though, and trying to relieve that pruritus. It can be associated with poor fetal outcomes, so patients who have this are considered to have a high-risk pregnancy. The much more serious illnesses involving the liver in pregnancy are severe preeclampsia, HELP, which is stands for hemolysis, elevated LFTs, and low platelets. And then the lower the platelets are in HELP syndrome, the more severe it is. And for those, for both severe preeclampsia and especially for HELP, really delivery of the fetus is the definitive therapy. And then finally, acute fatty liver of pregnancy, you can see elevated portal pressure, so portal hypertension, encephalopathy, elevated ammonia, and this really requires delivery and sometimes even liver transplant. The mortality rate for both HELP and acute fatty liver of pregnancy can be up to 25%, so these are very serious. All right, let's talk about cirrhosis and portal hypertension. So cirrhosis is the end of a long course of chronic liver disease where areas of fibrosis and regenerative nodules replace the normal liver lobules. Blood flow is disrupted, shunts form, and increased resistance produces increased portal pressures or portal hypertension. When portal hypertension gets severe, so a gradient between the portal pressure and the post-liver venous pressure, greater than 10 to 12, you start to get systemic issues. So what are those? You get issues in terms of hemostasis. So there's an imbalance in bleeding and clotting. The liver, we, as we said before, produces all of the clotting factors except 3, 4, and 8. It also clears activated factors. But in addition to that, the liver makes proteins C and S, which are anticoagulant factors. So decreased levels of protein C may balance out the decreased coagulant factors and leave your thrombin generation relatively similar. This is why looking at measurements such as PT and INR in chronic liver patients may not actually give you a good idea of their risk for bleeding because you're not measuring the protein C function. Cirrhotics may actually be prothrombotic due to reduced protein C, antithrombin 3, and increased factor 8 and von Willebrand's factor. So even though they have elevated INRs, they may actually be prothrombotic. So you have to be very careful in how you think about that, and certainly shouldn't willy-nilly just transfuse FFP to get the INR down if they're not bleeding. Cholestatic diseases, as I said before, can result in vitamin K deficiency because that bile secretion is necessary for vitamin K absorption. Giving vitamin K can correct this, but it won't help in true hepatocellular dysfunction where the liver can't make the factor. So that can help distinguish that. Fibrinogen can be low, but even if it's not low, it can also be dysfunctional in these patients. Low platelets, I said before I would talk more about this. So very common for liver disease patients to have low platelets. It's multifactorial. So the liver does produce thrombopoietin, and you will have low levels of thrombopoietin. So that is, most people think that's the main reason. But actually, you can also see up to 90% of the platelet population sequestered in the spleen due to portal hypertension. So that's a major reason for low platelets in liver disease. you have to have platelets of at least 50,000 to support near normal thrombin generation. And that's where that recommendation we often hear to transfuse to keep patients above 50 in bleeding patients comes from. And that is still the case even in liver patients. If they're bleeding, you want to try to keep their platelet levels above 50. But again, if they're not bleeding, really 10,000 can be your transfusion threshold. These patients can be hyperfibrinolytic. You can see that on a thromboelastogram, a TEG, or another form of thromboelastography. And giving Amicar or tranexamic acid can help in those patients. They have relatively low risk of DIC, but it can happen, especially with a stimulus like sepsis or SBP, spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. So you still want to think about DIC, but it is not super common in these patients.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, and we're back with more liver physiology. You can get a lot of cardiac manifestations, and this is really important and will definitely come up on tests. So these patients tend to be hyperdynamic. They have a high cardiac output, low systemic vascular resistance, and low arterial blood pressure at baseline. And they love to ask about this on tests, especially they will give you, at least as an answer choice, that a patient has low SVR, which is true in these liver patients. They are likely to have low SVR, but they'll also get at asking you if they have high, normal, or low contractility, and they're trying to trick you because you think, oh, they have high cardiac output, they therefore must have high contractility. And in fact, no. These patients often have liver-induced cardiomyopathy, which reduces both systolic and diastolic function, but they have high cardiac outputs primarily because of the low SVR. So don't confuse high cardiac output with good systolic function or with good contractility. It would be accurate to say these patients are more likely to have low contractility even with a high cardiac output. And then again, that's because of that low systemic vascular resistance. Turns out their pulmonary vascular resistance is often normal. Their effective circulating volume is reduced because of the sequestration of a lot of volume in dilated splanchnic vessels and because that portal hypertension produces vasodilators, which cause vasodilation and pooling of blood, which then takes it out of the circulating volume. Liver failure patients are at high risk for autonomic dysfunction and prolonged QTC, other things to keep in mind. All right, let's talk about the renal system. So this is another highly important and tested one. You will get a lot of renal dysfunction in end-stage liver patients. They will have inappropriate retention of sodium and free water, which can lead to hepatorenal syndrome. We'll talk about that in a minute. Renal dysfunction is a major mortality predictor. In fact, it's one of only three variables in the MELD score. So it's really important to remember that this plays a major role in prognosis. The kidneys will try to maintain perfusion by making lots of prostaglandins. So cirrhotics are really dependent on those prostaglandins for kidney function, so they're very sensitive to NSAIDs, and you want to try to avoid NSAIDs in these patients. It can be hard to distinguish intravascular hypovolemia, which they tend to have, from hepatorenal syndrome. And the way you can do that is try giving albumin. If the creatinine doesn't improve, that suggests hepatorenal syndrome. If it's just intravascular hypovolemia and you give albumin, then increasing that intravascular volume should help improve your creatinine. So that's a way to try to tell the difference. So let's talk about hepatorenal syndrome. In cirrhotics with ascites, the incidence of hepatorenal syndrome is 18% at 1 year and 40% at 5 years. So really high rates of this happening. There are two types of hepatorenal syndrome. Type 1 is rapid onset with at least doubling of the creatinine over 2 weeks related to some cause. So it could be SBP commonly. It's often associated with spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, SBP. Could be sepsis. Could be a GI bleed or surgery that kicks this off. And then you see a rapid doubling or more of the creatinine within 2 weeks. That's going to be type 1 HRS. It's very serious. The median survival is only 2 to 4 weeks without therapy. It's also associated with adrenal insufficiency. But the good news is when it responds to therapy, it usually will be a sustained response and it's unlikely to recur. Type 2 hepatorenal syndrome is more indolent. It usually is associated with refractory ascites. The median survival is 6 months, and it is, again, because that refractory ascites, it tends to be difficult, and if it does respond, it will often come back. So what is therapy for hepatorenal syndrome? The only proven therapy is a combination of volume expansion with albumin and vasopressors. If you're in the ICU, that can be norepinephrine and vasopressin. If you are not, then you're talking about more oral vasopressors or whatever you can give outside the ICU. Midodrine, obviously, being a major one. The therapy, as I said, is much more effective in type 1, and it's more sustained. And in type 2, it usually comes back if it works at all. You want to treat with the albumin and pressors for 1 to 2 weeks, and hopefully you will see some resolution. If that fails, TIPS, which is transjugular intrahepatic portal shunt, can help reduce the ascites, but you often have a high rate of stenosis of that stent and migration, and so some places don't like to do it as much. Transplant, of course, is definitive therapy. Now, after a liver transplant, your kidneys can recover, and you have a reasonable shot at that, but it probably depends partly on how long the patient was on dialysis. If a patient was on dialysis for more than 6 weeks before the liver transplant, frequent dialysis for more than 6 weeks, they may actually need a liver kidney transplant because they have a little bit lower probability of their kidneys recovering. But certainly liver transplant can lead to kidney recovery in these patients. Let's talk about pulmonary complications, another frequently tested thing. Hepatopulmonary syndrome is a very commonly seen complication in end-stage liver disease. You will see a combination of liver dysfunction, hypoxemia, and intrapulmonary vascular dilation. So patients will have a PaO2 less than 80 or an AA gradient of at least 15 on room air. And in fact, this is what one of the hallmarks is, this increased AA gradient. You may see that as an answer choice on a test, as in which of the following are likely in a liver disease patient, an increased AA gradient or hypoxemia. These are things that you might choose and would be true because of this hepatopulmonary syndrome. Findings on contrast echo are pulmonary vascular dilation. So the dilation acts as shunts. And so usually what you have are these just massively dilated vessels, which aren't true shunts, meaning they don't actually go around the alveoli, but they're dilated enough that you don't get good gas exchange. Because they aren't true shunts, they're usually correctable with supplemental oxygen. But sometimes, if it's severe enough, you can get true shunts developing, and those then would not correct with oxygen. The other hallmark in these patients is orthodioxia, and that's because these dilations tend to be worse at the lung bases, and so when a patient stands, they will get more hypoxemic. That's orthodioxia. This is a popular test question about either the hypoxia or asking for the mechanism, and the mechanism is those intrapulmonary shunts. And that usually will correct within about a year of getting a liver transplant. And because of that, because it will correct as long as you get that transplant, but over time it can actually get bad enough that it might not correct as well. You actually do get extra MELD points for having significant hepatopulmonary syndrome. The other major pulmonary syndrome involved with liver disease is portal pulmonary hypertension. And this is pulmonary hypertension in a patient with portal hypertension and no other known cause of the pulmonary hypertension. It happens in about 4 to 6% of liver transplant candidates. Therapy includes diuresis and vasodilators. You can't really use calcium channel blockers because they can worsen portal hypertension. So you're talking about things like epoprostenol, sildenafil, bosentan, which is an endothelin antagonist. Transplant may help, but not always in these patients. And so in order to get a transplant, they need to have a mean pulmonary artery pressure less than 35, because otherwise they really won't tolerate transplant surgery. Sometimes they'll be put on these vasodilators to try to bring their mean pulmonary artery pressure down less than 35 so that they can still be a transplant candidate. But again, the transplant may not actually help. Hepatic encephalopathy. So we talked a little about this before. There's both neuropsychologic, as in the level of consciousness and attention, and neuromotor aspects like hyperreflexia, clonus, the Babinski sign, nystagmus. Ammonia, as we said before, probably contributes, but there's other toxins as well, gut-derived neurotoxins, inflammatory mediators also. The first thing to do is rule out other causes of altered mental status, even in a liver patient, not to just assume that it's hepatic encephalopathy. And if there is something going on, like sepsis, treat the underlying cause. If that doesn't work, then you want to work on trying to reduce the ammonia. So lactulose is probably the most common treatment. And what happens is that anaerobic bacteria in the colon will ferment it and make acid, which acidifies the colon, which turns ammonia into ammonium, which is then poorly absorbed. So more of that ammonia then is excreted. It also increases stool output, which is thought to reduce absorption by itself of ammonia. Zinc is another thing we often give to these patients. It's a cofactor in the urea cycle, which helps to process and get rid of ammonia. And so if you give more zinc, the thought is they may be able to better process the ammonia themselves. And then antibiotics like rifaximin may help reduce ammonia-producing bacteria in the intestines. Ascites. So ascites is the most common complication leading to hospitalization in liver patients. And once ascites develops, there's 50% mortality in 3 years. There are other causes of ascites, though, not just liver disease, and those are malignancy, heart failure, renal disease, pancreatitis, and TB. You'll hear about the serum ascites albumin gradient, or SAG. If it's that obviously is defined by taking the serum albumin, the ascites albumin, and subtracting. If it is 1.1 or more, that is very predictive of portal hypertension. It's got 97% accuracy for predicting portal hypertension as the cause of the ascites if the serum ascites albumin gradient is 1.1 milligrams per deciliter or more. The initial therapy for ascites is going to be salt restriction, just 2 grams a day, and diuretics. They'll often have hyponatremia. And if they do, if it's bad enough, meaning really if it's below 125, you can fluid restrict them. Careful correcting hyponatremia, because these tend to be patients who have chronic hyponatremia and they're at high risk of central pontine myelinolysis. So you want to go slow as 2 millequivalents per liter per day. So if they're at 120, you want to go maybe up to 122. In a day, then 124 in another day, very slow. This is assuming they're asymptomatic, which they probably will be. If they're slow enough that they're seizing, you may have to increase a little faster. Paracentesis, obviously, is a way both to get fluid to send for studies to diagnose the cause of ascites, but also to relieve the pressure if it's large volume. You'll often hear you have to replace albumin if you drain ascites. Really not if it's less than 5 liters. If it's really large volume, more than 5 liters, then the recommendation is to give about 6 to 8 grams of albumin for every liter taken off. There's not really great evidence for that, though. What you do get asked about, though, on tests is what if they take off fluid, either large volume paracentesis, or you go to the OR for, let's say, an XLAP, and when they open the abdomen, there's a lot of fluid in there, and they take off large volume ascites intraoperatively from the peritoneum, then what happens? And they may give you a scenario where you have an acute drop in blood pressure and or saturation. You can get that drop in saturation because of decreased perfusion, of course, when you have an acute drop in blood pressure. So it really would be drop in blood pressure, drop in saturation when they've gone in for the XLAP and taken a bunch of fluid off. And what you want to remember is that these patients have relative hypovolemia. And that's what this is likely due to, is that relative hypovolemia when they've taken off all of that albumin from the belly. These patients are very leaky, and they're likely to now refill fluid into that abdomen, losing more intravascular volume. So they have this relative hypovolemia, and that's the cause. You want to think in these acute events, don't go for those distractor answers, the chronic things like, oh, they mentioned a DSAT, so it must be hepatopulmonary syndrome, or they mentioned hypotension, it must be because they had an acute MI, right? It's more likely when they take off a large volume that what they're getting at are these fluid shifts or relative hypovolemia. We talked about TIPS, which can help reduce ascites, but again, has some risks like increased hepatic encephalopathy because now you're shunting blood around the liver, so it's not getting detoxified. And as I mentioned before, a relatively high rate of shunt failure. Spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, or SBP, is diagnosed when the PMNs in the fluid are 250 or more without another obvious intra-abdominal source. Usually comes from translocation from the bowel. And it's important to start antibiotics right away because this can lead to sepsis and it can lead to type 1 hepatorenal syndrome. And in fact, there is an albumin dosing regimen of large volume albumin dosing in a patient who you think has SBP to try to prevent it from leading to hepatorenal syndrome. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Varices are obviously a difficult thing in these patients. They come from portosystemic collaterals under high pressure. They're most often gastric and esophageal and obviously can be catastrophic if they rupture. Treatment for varices, so non-selective beta blockers, which can reduce portal pressure by both decreasing cardiac output through their beta 1 blockade and through their beta 2 blockade, can cause some splanchnic vasoconstriction and help reduce the amount of blood flowing through those collaterals. You can also do endoscopic ligation prophylactically. For bleeding, they obviously need early ligation plus pharmacotherapy with vasopressin, vasopressin analogs, somatostatin, somatostatin analogs, and they may need intubation for airway protection. They may need factor replacement for bleeding. For resistant or recurrent bleeding, which happens in 10 to 20% of patients, you can try balloon tamponade, obviously potential major complications with that like esophageal rupture, or more definitive therapies like surgical shunt or TIPS. Chronic cholestatic disease, so biliary obstruction, causes elevated serum bilirubin, bile salts, and alk-phos. The lack of bile salts in the gut can lead to increased bacterial growth, increased endotoxin absorption, and that can also hurt the kidney. And then, of course, you can get things like ascending cholangitis. The primary diseases in adults are primary biliary sclerosis and primary sclerosing cholangitis. PBC, primary biliary cirrhosis, has known by having anti-mitochondrial antibodies, so you may see that pop up. Ursodeoxycholic acid can slow its progression, so that's a treatment patients will often be on. Transplant is the definitive treatment, but there's a 10 and up to 35% recurrence rate. PSC, primary sclerosing cholangitis, is associated with IBD and most commonly ulcerative colitis, and that can lead to cholangiocarcinoma. Transplant, again, the definitive therapy, but you can also get recurrence because these are thought to be autoimmune related. Chronic hepatocellular disease. So I mentioned before that NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, is becoming much more common. And while hepatitis C is still the most common cause of liver transplant, NAFLD is becoming more and more common. Hepatocellular carcinoma comes from those repeated cycles of inflammation and the cirrhosis. Transplant, of course, is a definitive treatment, but you can only do it if it's not too advanced. The Milan criteria are one tumor less than 5 centimeters or three tumors all less than 3 centimeters, still a candidate for liver transplant. Mentioned again, NAFLD has a spectrum. So you can have NAFLD, which is just steatosis, or it can include inflammation and necrosis, which makes it now NASH, which is non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So that's steatohepatitis, and it's that hepatitis that's associated with cirrhosis and hepatocellular carcinoma. So while the overall prevalence of NAFLD, which is very associated with metabolic syndrome and obesity, is more than 30% now in the United States, NASH, the hepatitis itself, is only 3 to 5%. Weight loss, including bariatric surgery, has major, major benefits in these patients. All right, let's talk about preoperative management. So patients without signs of liver disease should not get LFT labs for screening. Acute hepatitis has a very high perioperative mortality rate, and should people who are in the midst of an acute hepatitis episode should not get elective procedures at all. The CHILD score or the Child-Turco-Pugh score includes albumin, PT, INR, bilirubin, ascites, and encephalopathy. So it's a way of measuring liver disease. Class A, the more mild side, has a 10% post-op mortality. Class C, the most severe, has up to an 80% post-op mortality. So you can see how serious this is. You really don't want to be doing procedures on these severe liver disease patients if you don't have to. The MELD score, on the other hand, uses just creatinine, bilirubin, and INR. And a MELD score over 20 really contraindicates elective procedures until after a liver transplant. Now remember, after a liver transplant, once a patient settles in and things are going well with the transplant, so maybe a year or two post-transplant, you should assume that they won't have the stigmata of chronic liver disease anymore, meaning they won't have low albumin, they won't have hypoglycemia, they won't have hypoxemia because they had a transplant. But they may have issues from the transplant. So remember, they're going to be on immunosuppression, things like prednisone, which could cause hyperglycemia. Or they'll be on cyclosporin, which could cause elevated creatinine because it is nephrotoxic. So if you have a post-transplant patient and they ask what you're likely to see, don't get tripped up by going for those things that chronic liver disease patients have, like the hypoglycemia or the hypoxia. Go for the things that are associated with their transplant, things like hyperglycemia from the steroids or elevated creatinine from the cyclosporin. Intraoperatively, these patients need close monitoring. So patients with bad liver disease should have an A-line at least. You can use TEG to measure their coagulations, probably better than traditional coag studies. Traditionally, they often had CVPs, but there's not really good evidence for using CVP just for monitoring at least, though you may want it for access. Be careful with high neuraxial blocks. So T5 and above have been shown to reduce hepatic blood flow. So maybe not the best idea in patients with advanced liver disease. And of course, patients with advanced liver disease may have other contraindications to neuraxial blockade, like low platelets. Volatile anesthetics tend to preserve hepatic blood flow and are safe, though those questions of halothane, of course, can come up. IV anesthetics are fine, though liver disease patients may be more prone to propofol infusion syndrome, so that's something to keep in mind. They're often more sensitive to medications. Opioid metabolism is reduced, so you want to space out the intervals for your opiates. Non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockers are prolonged. The action is going to be prolonged, but interestingly, they may be resistant to the initial dose. So they need a higher initial dose, but it will last longer. So it's tricky, but you may see this come up on a test question. They need a higher initial dose, but that initial dose will have a longer duration of action. The neuromuscular blockers will also accumulate if you use an infusion. They'll accumulate more than in a patient without liver disease. Succinylcholine action can be prolonged because of reduced plasma cholinesterase activity, but this is often not clinically significant, and they don't tend to have a higher rate of phase 2 block. You may see that as a distractor answer on test questions. These patients have an increased volume of distribution, so while it may accumulate, it won't necessarily accumulate in plasma. So they won't necessarily have a higher concentration of neuromuscular blocker in plasma because they'll have a higher volume of distribution since they tend to have less circulating volume. And then remember, because this could trip you up on a test, that they won't have any difference in elimination or duration of cis-atricurium or atricurium because those are independent of liver function or of any organ function as they break down via Hoffman elimination. Same would be true of remifentanil, which is broken down by nonspecific tissue esterases. These patients have a reduced response to pressors, so you may need higher doses. Albumin, so we often think, oh, we should be giving them albumin. It's not necessarily better to give these patients albumin compared to any other patient, except in the setting of large volume paracentesis, or as I said, in spontaneous bacterial peritonitis to prevent HRS and in treatment of HRS itself. You'll often have surgeons ask for a low CVP leading into a liver resection. It's unclear if that actually matters. There's not good data for it. And of course, when you do have a low CVP strategy, you also have increased risk like air embolism. Cardiac surgery is really bad for these patients. For some reason, bypass really worsens their liver disease, and so they really should not be having elective cardiac surgery. And then finally, postoperatively, the larger the hepatectomy, the higher the risk of complications, including pleural effusions, biliary leak, wound breakdown, ascites, and abscess formation. Post-op liver dysfunction can come from hypoperfusion, infection, heart failure, the drugs they get. There's a lot of reasons why their liver disease can get worse post-op. Postoperative hyperbilirubinemia, if it's unconjugated, is probably from blood breakdown. They may have gotten blood product transfusion, and now it's breaking down. So that hyperbilirubinemia that's unconjugated is likely from that. If it's conjugated, more than 50% of it is conjugated, think about cholestasis or hepatocellular dysfunction. If your alkaline phosphatase and direct bili, your conjugated bili, are up out of proportion to others, like your LFTs, especially after a cholecystectomy, think about a retained stone. Don't get hung up on distractor answers on a test like hepatitis, acute hepatitis, or halothane hepatitis, or anything like that. If they had cholecystitis and went in for a cholecystectomy, and now they've got elevations in their alkaline phosphatase and direct bili, think about a retained stone. It's pretty common to have mild increases in transaminases postoperatively, and you don't need to do anything about it. And you definitely don't need to do anything different on a prior anesthetic, like a hepatitis screen or any different change in the volatile anesthetic that you give. If they had a mild transaminase increases for a few days after a surgery before, they may have it again for another few days, but it's not something that needs to be acted on or stop you from doing any specific anesthetic.
All right, let's do some random recommendations. It's just me today. It's been a while since I have done one of these without a guest, and so I am going to make the random recommendations, but actually we've got a few audience random recommendations that I will share. These are old. I'm sorry I misplaced them, and so thanks to the folks who sent them in, and here they come. So one is the book What Your Food Ate, and that came as a recommendation from Tyler Jones. Thank you, Tyler. And then we have another couple of recommendations from Henry Lather. So Henry recommends a non-clinical recommendation, which is the series called The King Killer Chronicles by Patrick Rothfuss. I have read the two that exist. I agree with him. They're fabulous. But I also agree with him about his caveat, which is that he recommends not starting them until the third book in the series is published. It's been expected for about 12 years, he says. And there is quite the fan speculation as to whether it will ever come out. I would agree. I would not start them, as good as they are, unless we find out that the third book is actually coming out. And then he has a clinical recommendation, which is the YouTube channel Regional Anesthesiology and Acute Pain Medicine. And we'll put the link in the show notes. He says his bias from doing residency aside, he thinks it's the best video resource for regional blocks. In his short time in private practice so far, he's watched them before doing some of the less commonly performed blocks, and they've been really helpful. And then I want to make a huge shout out myself. My random recommendation is going to be for ACRAC in Spanish. That's right. We now have, thanks to the really wonderful work of Juan Jose Morales Behene, the launch of an ACRAC in Spanish podcast. We'll put the link in the show notes and feel free to check it out. There will be hopefully more and more of the episodes translated into Spanish, and I'm really grateful to Juan for putting this together. All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. Thank you so much for the great work that you do.
Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com.
All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.